Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Stuart England, The Civil Wars, episode 2.111, conclusion. Well, it's been a fun 4 years. I started this project as a way to continue reading and writing about history after my decision to leave professional academia, but it's really taken on a life of its own that I couldn't have imagined. It turns out running a podcast involves all the best aspects of teaching. You get to read books all day and interact with people who are just as passionate about history as you. And you get to cut out all the dreary parts of the job. Very rarely have I been called in for a podcast or faculty meeting. I suppose there's less money in podcasting, but since when is money an important part of a job? Anyway, this is my roundabout way of thanking you all for introducing me to the wonderful world of history podcasting. It was a bumpy ride at times, especially at the beginning. A friend of mine once noted that the show really picked up when I decided to buy a microphone, instead of yelling into a tin can with a string running out of the bottom. It certainly has been an educational experience, in everything from production to editing to learning how to speak to an empty room without sounding like a robot. But I'm glad you guys stuck with me. What I'd like to do in this final episode is lay out a mini epilogue to get a sense of where the characters we've all grown to love are headed from here, answer a few viewer questions that have come in, then offer some concluding thoughts on the whole project. Why was it worth spending more than 100 hours contemplating the first half of the 17th century in England? Surely there was a good reason. Otherwise, we've all made some poor life decisions. We'll start by rounding out the story from last time. As I'm sure you remember, King Charles II formally entered London in triumph on the 29th of May, 1660, technically the 11th year of his reign, but for all practical purposes, the beginning of the late Stuart era. Earlier that month, Parliament had decreed that England would be ruled by King, Lords, and Commons, and now each of those institutions were present and accounted for. The real work could begin. Although Charles had made an excellent impression with his magnanimous declaration of Breda, there were still several contentious issues to resolve, each of them capable of ruining the joyful atmosphere in London and Westminster. Charles did his best to keep the goodwill going by surrounding himself with a collaborative council. His advisors included those who can loosely be described as Cromwellians, men who had never been full-throated supporters of the various regimes that had followed the Protectorate, and who had, to varying degrees, aided the return of the king. Leading the way here were George Monk and Edward Montagu, both of whom were prominent in the king's formal escort home. Charles also invited as many as 8 Presbyterians into his council, men who had been purged from Parliament in 1648, and so were untainted by any association with the regicidal Republican regime. The important names here were the Earl of Manchester, Denzil Holles, and Arthur Annesley, the Anglo-Irish leader who had recently risen to prominence as Monk's close ally in Parliament. In many ways, the first month of the Parliament had been a blow to Presbyterian designs. Their efforts to place conditions on the king's return had been stymied, as had an attempt to make Manchester the dominant figure in the king's council. Despite Presbyterian arguments to the contrary, Parliament determined that Charles had the prerogative to choose his own advisers. But the new king had no desire to alienate the Presbyterians. By including so many of them in his council, Charles encouraged them to believe that their voices would be heard. The council would be a communal body, but there was little doubt about who the king's closest advisor would be, Chancellor Edward Hyde. It was Hyde who had guided Charles through his years in exile, and the miraculous and largely bloodless restoration was a vindication of Hyde's constitutional vision. For the next 7 years, Hyde would be the de facto chief minister of the royal administration. With a coherent government now in place, the king could begin working with Parliament to hash out England's new political settlement. In the immediate term, the Declaration of Breda had identified the 4 major issues that needed to be addressed: amnesties, religion, determining the ownership of land seized by Parliament, and paying off the army so it could be safely disbanded. As you recall, in each case, Charles deferred to Parliament, relieving himself of the burden of making any controversial decisions. The Parliament passed a fairly lenient Bill of Indemnity and Oblivion. In fact, some of the most ardent royalists complained that the bill delivered indemnities to the king's enemies and oblivion to his friends. In general, all past rebellions were forgiven, so long as men now swore their loyalty to the king. There were exceptions, however. Those that could be directly tied to the trial and execution of Charles I were explicitly named and exempted from any amnesty. Though inclusion on this unfortunate list wasn't entirely cut and dry. Personal connections and recent behavior counted too. Those who had friends in the new regime, willing to vouch for them, were usually granted clemency. A bribe or two to the right people helped as well. Bulstrode Whitelock, who had provided the constitutional justification for much of the Commonwealth and Protectorate state apparatus, greased a few palms and was rewarded with an audience with the king himself. After some pleasant chit-chat, Charles advised Whitelock to retire from public life and enjoy his country estate, advice he was grateful to accept. Meanwhile, Henry Cromwell was allowed to retain the properties he had accumulated in Ireland. This was largely due to the lobbying of George Monk and Roger Boyle, who convinced the royal administration that this Cromwell had, like them, done much to oppose the radical regimes that followed the collapse of the Protectorate. Arthur Haselrig, for so long the face of English republicanism, was also offered a degree of leniency. Once it was obvious that the rump was doomed, Monk had secured from Haselrig a pledge to quietly retire from politics. Haselrig kept up his end of the bargain by denouncing John Lambert's insurrection in April and not standing for election for the new parliament. Monk reciprocated by convincing Charles to commute Haselrig's death sentence. Though it was little consolation for Haselrig, who died in the Tower of London a few months later, in January 1661. Religion, as you can imagine, was a far thornier problem. The Presbyterians still hoped for a Calvinist national church. The return of bishops seemed inevitable, but at the very least, they argued for a more decentralized model that would curtail their powers. That would be a bitter pill for the bishops who had joined the king in exile, and expected that they would be restored along with their patron. Meanwhile, those who worshipped outside the established church pointed to Charles's promise of liberty to tender consciences in the Declaration of Breda. Radical groups like the Quakers enjoyed little sympathy in Parliament, but by 1660, more mainstream independent churches had taken root in English society. Their adherents were not cats that would be willingly stuffed back in the bag of an established church, if that metaphor makes any sense. Unsurprisingly, religion sparked the most contentious debates of the whole Parliament. In the end, Westminster took a page out of the King's book and deferred a final decision. Everyone agreed to hold a synod later in the year, where learned scholars would debate the issue, and Charles would act as arbiter. But seeing as any decision would have to be ratified by Parliament, this was, in effect, a delaying tactic. To skip ahead a bit, this is, after all, an epilogue, the delay worked to the advantage of the bishops and the traditional established church. The religious question would be determined by the next parliament, opened in the spring of 1661. For reasons we'll touch on in a moment, the Presbyterians and Independents wielded much less influence in that subsequent session, allowing for the return of a much more traditional, established church. This was an early indication of the long-term strategy behind the Declaration of Breda. For Hyde, the conciliatory tone of the king's initial position was tactical, a way to buy time. In order to ensure the success of the Restoration, Charles had to make as many friends as possible. But once ensconced in power, time was on the side of the royalists. Over time, allies of convenience could be abandoned, and piece by piece, the old constitution restored. Land posed an entirely different problem for the king. Delay wasn't really a viable option. The king's friends, who had suffered the loss of their properties while in exile, expected the immediate restoration of their estates, a just reward for their loyalty. But neither Charles nor Hyde saw any political upside in the forcible redistribution of property. This was the source of the earlier complaint I mentioned, that the king's enemies enjoyed indemnity, while his friends faced oblivion. What kind of sense did it make for Oliver Cromwell's son in Ireland to retain his lands, while men who had stood by the king for years got nothing? Monk suggested a compromise. Confiscated lands would be restored, but the men who had purchased them from Parliament would stay on as tenants under generous leases. Like all good compromises, however, no one liked Monk's idea, and it was roundly defeated in Parliament. Instead, a different compromise was reached. Crown and church lands would be restored to their original owners, but before retaking possession, they would pay for any improvements that had been made to the land. The process of surveying lands to determine the value of any improvements was complicated and easily manipulated by the well-connected men who surrounded the king. Landowners who had made peace with the royal administration enjoyed quick surveys and generous payouts. Meanwhile, the program was limited to former church and crown lands, leaving many royalist lords and gentlemen out in the cold. They could console themselves with the option of taking their disputes to the civil courts through lawsuits, but that could be a lengthy, expensive process. and some lands were deemed irretrievable. The Earl of Derby, the king's most loyal subject in the northwest of England, found that much of his family's land was gone forever. Some of it he had willingly sold in order to raise money to pay fines and taxes to Parliament. Others he had given away in trusts to protect against seizure. Derby argued that justice demanded the return of those properties. He was informed by the courts, however, that property law trumps justice. The land issue was perhaps the least successful of the king's gambles. Royalists who were unsatisfied with the land compromises directed most of their ire at the rebels who had illegally confiscated their lands. But they saved some of their resentment for the king, who failed to appreciate their loyalty and stand up for their rights. Charles could not take the support of ultra-royalists for granted, a lesson that would influence his decisions in the early years of his reign. Finally was the problem of the army, which in reality was the familiar problem of money. Most everyone agreed that the army had played a destructive role in politics over the past few years, an assessment George Monk had made explicit shortly before the king was invited back to England. The only issue to be resolved was how to raise the money necessary to pay off the soldiers and have them disband peacefully. Parliament approved a poll tax on every subject, their contributions determined by social rank, and when that proved insufficient, army pay was supplemented by additional taxes on property holders. By the end of 1660, the men of the army had received all the pay they were owed. For 15 years, one of the most powerful institutions in England, the New Model Army dissolved peacefully at the beginning of 1661. The king retained a small personal guard of less than 4,000 men. Its size and political influence would be restricted by limited crown finances and a general antipathy within England for standing armies. Paying out the New Model Army led into a more general settlement on public finances. In effect, Westminster revisited the idea of the Great Contract, proposed by Robert Cecil in 1610. After closely reviewing the costs of maintaining a government, Westminster agreed to an annual budget for the crown of just under £1 million. The need for the crown to raise money irregularly through prerogative perks was therefore removed, and with it, many of the abuses that had bred resentment towards the administrations of James I and Charles I. Having completed its work, on the 29th of December, Parliament was dissolved by King Charles II. Though completed is a bit misleading. There were many details yet to be worked out, especially in the always contentious realm of religion. In reality, the Restoration Settlement would be a prolonged process, which at times even reversed some of the decisions made at Westminster in 1660. It would take a whole other podcast series, maybe someday, to untangle that whole mess. But I thought I'd end with some of the early harbingers of what the Restoration era would have in store. Charles's reign would be defined by two tensions, the line of succession and the balance between the warring factions that had been reconciled in 1660. So far, Charles had proven himself to be a skilled politician, but navigating those dual challenges would not be easy. To take the king's family first, when Charles returned to England in 1660, there was every reason to believe the Stuart line was well supplied with heirs. Charles was unmarried, but he was just 30 years old, and now the undisputed king of England. He would surely be a great prize on the European marriage market. Meanwhile, he had four surviving siblings, including two younger brothers, James, Duke of York, and Henry, Duke of Gloucester. But soon after Charles's return to England, the Stuart family suffered a series of blows. In September 1660, Henry died, either from smallpox or from the actions of doctors who were trying to save him from smallpox. Shortly thereafter, Charles's sister Mary, who had married William of Orange back in 1641, also died. Though setting aside the personal tragedy, this was not necessarily a problem from a dynastic perspective. Charles could fully expect to produce his own heirs, and he still had his remaining brother, James. But another development that fall muddied the family waters still further. In a scandalous revelation, Edward Hyde's daughter, Anne, revealed that she was pregnant, thanks to James, Duke of York, who she had secretly married earlier that year. James initially denied the allegation, but when witnesses to the private marriage ceremony came forward, he was forced to admit the truth of it. The scandal was doubly problematic for Charles. First, his brother and current heir to the throne had demonstrated a shocking lack of judgment, both in terms of marrying Anne Hyde and attempting to cover it up. James could very well be the King of England someday, and so his choice of wife ought to have been a matter of politics, diplomacy, and strategy, not a secret ceremony to legitimize a tryst. James's ham-handed approach to the resulting scandal also demonstrated a troubling incompetence in a potential king. He could perhaps be excused on account of his youth, but James was now 25 years old, hardly a child. If he was going to turn into a respectable royal, time was running out. The second headache James had given his brother had to do with who he had married. Anne's father was Charles's closest advisor, which was a real problem. Among some royalists, Hyde was already resented for his influence over the king. Some had always disagreed with his constitutional approach to royalism, and others were aristocrats who hated playing second fiddle to a commoner like Hyde. The news that Hyde's family was now joined to that of the royal line was greeted with outrage. It was all too easy to believe that this had not been some unplanned indiscretion. It would make perfect sense for a schemer like Hyde to manipulate his way into the Stuart dynasty. Charles tried to put the best face on the situation and elevated Hyde to the peerage, naming him the Earl of Clarendon. But to his critics, this merely reinforced their suspicions that he was the puppet master behind the restored monarchy. Resentment towards Hyde made it much more difficult for Charles to manage the factions within his government. Not only did he have to balance the interests of men like Monk and Montagu against their bitter enemies among his most loyal entourage, but now he had to contend with a chief minister who seemed to be resented by everyone. Charles would spend the next 25 years trying to balance the roiling factions within English political life. Many of the decisions he made in that time can be traced back to the instability within his own family in the opening weeks of his reign. Of course, Charles wasn't the only one whose life was reshaped by the events of 1660. Some used the uncertainty and turmoil of the transition to their advantage. Topping the list has to be George Monk, who had done more than anyone else to engineer the Restoration. He was rewarded with an elevation to the nobility, estates in Ireland and England, and high political office, both a seat on the Privy Council and the office of Lord Deputy of Ireland. Monk, however, soon stepped back from public life, partially due to ill health. He resigned from his position in Ireland and was replaced by the Marquess of Ormond, for 20 years the face of royalism in Ireland. Monk enjoyed the benefits of his private largesse, returning to military service in the Second Anglo-Dutch War of 1665 to 1667. He died in 1670, at the age of 61. Edward Montagu also reaped the rewards of his role in the Restoration. Like Monk, Montagu was granted a noble title, the Earl of Sandwich. Charles also named him the Admiral of the Narrow Seas, and made him a key figure in the naval and diplomatic arms of the new administration. Montagu was therefore front and center in the Second and Third Anglo-Dutch Wars that Charles fought against his one-time hosts in the Netherlands. In fact, he died in battle against the Dutch in 1672, when the royal flagship he was commanding was sunk in the Battle of Sole Bay. Roger Boyle prospered out of the Restoration as well. The king rewarded him with lands in Ireland and a promotion to an earldom. More importantly, Boyle secured the office of Lord President of Munster, making him the most powerful man in the south of Ireland. From there, Boyle waged a kind of political war with the Marquess of Ormond, who ruled from Dublin. In a sense, it was Irish politics as usual. The new English Boyle persistently nipped at the heels of the old English Ormond. But not everyone who had fought against the king was forgiven. Unrepentant regicides like the fifth monarchist Thomas Harrison, the rump spymaster Thomas Scott, and the preacher Hugh Peter were apprehended and executed. Henry Vane was targeted too. Although he hadn't participated in the trial and execution of the old king, Charles found it impossible to forgive Vane's repeated denunciations of the institution of monarchy, and after a lengthy debate in Parliament, he was sentenced to death. The Marquess of Argyll, so long the most powerful man in Scotland, suffered a similar fate. After the Restoration, Argyll traveled to London in hopes of reconciling with the newly returned king. But Charles had not forgotten the indignities he had undergone in order to win Argyll's support back in 1650. The Scottish lord was cleared of any involvement in the execution of Charles I, but his subsequent cooperation with the Commonwealth was deemed treasonable. It's a testament to how arbitrary the line was between reconciliation and retribution that much of the evidence against Argyll came from his correspondence with fellow Commonwealth and Protectorate collaborator George Monk. Monk enjoyed wealth and influence after the Restoration. Argyll had his head chopped off. Other Commonwealth or Protectorate figures found the king open to appeals for mercy. Charles Fleetwood, Bulstrode Whitelock, and Oliver St. John escaped without any criminal punishment, though they were barred from holding public office for the rest of their lives. Richard and Henry Cromwell weren't punished at all. They were allowed to live out the rest of their lives in obscurity. More stalwart enemies of the monarchy, like Arthur Haselrig and John Lambert, were imprisoned and sentenced to death. But Charles graciously commuted their sentences, largely on the advice of George Monk and others. In the end, their defiance evaporated, and the king saw the advantage of a benevolent response to their pleas for mercy. Though neither Haselrig nor Lambert had pleasant lives after the Restoration. As we've seen, Haselrig died after less than a year in the Tower, and while Lambert survived for another 24 years, he spent all of that time in confinement. 40 years old at the time of his arrest, Lambert spent the last third of his life in a declining mental state that eventually ended in insanity. Charles saved his greatest animosity for those regicides who were already dead. After the Restoration, the bodies of Oliver Cromwell and John Bradshaw were exhumed and ceremonially hanged in their shrouds. Afterwards, their skulls were displayed in Westminster Hall, for Charles is a pale facsimile of the justice that had been stolen by Cromwell's fatal illness. It also acted as a symbolic representation of the reconciliation England was undergoing. Cromwell was a convenient villain. He was safely beyond the grave, and so all the evils of the past 20 years could be heaped onto him at little political cost. Any animosity the king's royalist entourage might harbor towards parliamentary leaders like Monk, Montagu, or Boyle could be safely redirected towards Cromwell's corpse. That didn't erase the tensions within Restoration England. The scars of the Civil War couldn't be healed so easily, but it was a useful fiction that allowed politics to function. In that way, the Restoration was a return to pre-war norms. Just as in James's day, it didn't benefit anyone to examine too closely the fundamental assumptions of the political world. So what had changed with the Restoration? The return of the king didn't really settle the constitutional questions that had plagued England since James came down from Scotland. The warm reception Charles received on the streets of London was not an expression of popular support for an ultra-royalist interpretation of the monarchy. The mood would be more accurately described as a rejection of republicanism and the rule of the army. For many, especially of the younger generation, the Commonwealth or Protectorate were far more familiar than the rule of kings, which had taken on a kind of mythic quality. Edward Hyde and other royalists hoped to gradually direct England back towards an idealized version of the old monarchy, but the 1640s and 1650s couldn't be erased from English history. The memory of that turbulent period would continue to shape English political culture for decades and centuries to come. If anything, the legacy of the Civil Wars wasn't so much the restoration of the monarchy, but a rejection of radical republicanism and army politics. After the failure of the instrument of government and the humble petition and advice, generations of English political thinkers developed an aversion to written constitutions. Rules and systems that sprang from the mind of one man, or even a group of men, would always be flawed and easily exploited. The only way to ensure lasting stability was to follow the lead of Edward Coke and look to the past. History was a laboratory, the only true test that could determine the value and staying power of constitutional ideals and institutions. Secondly, the 1650s exploded any faith in divine providence as a reliable guide for constitutional politics. Radical religion and political power had proved to be a dangerous, combustible mix. The toleration of dissenting churches remained a hotly contested issue in English politics for centuries to come, but radical religion would never again be a justification for constitutional change. Finally, the Civil War period confirmed English distrust of standing armies. In James's day, parliaments had balked at the cost of even modest, temporary armies. In the lead-up to the Civil War, those concerns of economy turned to outright suspicion when Charles and Parliament battled over control of the militias. But the determining factor was the outsized role the army played in the politics of the post-war period. To many in England, the New Model Army had fought for laudable principles, and perhaps their interventions at Westminster prevented disasters of royalist or radical takeovers. But by 1660, the argument that the army could deliver political stability had been thoroughly debunked. As a political institution, the army couldn't justify itself on representative grounds, nor an appeal to tradition. Neither did it appear capable of delivering results in the form of political stability. Army politics had failed, and generations of English men and women came to believe that it would always be destined to fail. Almost by default, monarchy was the only alternative, which is the tragedy of the mid-17th century. After two decades of warfare and civil strife, England was back where it had started. Like his grandfather and father before him, Charles II would spend his reign trying to figure out how a political system designed to rule over a medieval society could be adapted to an early modern world. This Charles had the benefit of hindsight and had already shown an ability to avoid the mistakes his father had made. He also had new tools to work with. The Commonwealth and Protectorate regimes had created new administrative instruments and a far more centralized bureaucracy than anything the early Stuarts had enjoyed. And the new king was canny enough to realize that restoring the monarchy didn't necessarily mean throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Of course, he also inherited a far more divided England. King James had been forced to deal with factional infighting, but he had never been asked to knit together enemies who had literally squared off in battle. The other side of the coin was that England now knew the stakes at play. Failure meant a return to civil war, the costs of which no one underestimated. But I'll stop my rambling before I end up convincing myself to do a podcast series on the Restoration, perhaps someday. I wanted to end this long journey with a few thought-provoking questions listeners have graciously sent my way. Joseph pointed out the legacy of the Civil War period on the founding of the United States, a connection I know little about, but has always fascinated me. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and I'm sure most of the Founding Fathers, were students of history, and surely would have seen the relevance of the rebellions and revolutions of the mid-17th century to their 18th century predicament. More indirectly, throughout the podcast, we've seen heated debate on ideas such as popular sovereignty, religious liberty, determining when armed revolt is justified, the balance of powers, and the nature of written constitutions. Whether explicitly referenced or not, the patriots of the 1770s were reaching 120 years into the past to make their arguments. I suppose the obvious place to start with the connection between the English Civil War and the American Revolution is Kevin Phillips's The Cousins Wars, which ties together the English Civil War, the American Revolution, and the American Civil War, a span of more than 200 years. I'm usually not a fan of history with that kind of epic scope, but Phillips throws up some interesting parallels. In the 18th century, the large British military presence in the colonies, especially after the Seven Years' War with France, spurred comparisons to the use of armed muscle by the Stuart kings. Though interestingly, the army politics of the 1640s and 1650s seems to have held a more ambivalent meaning for the colonists. An even more direct parallel might be drawn between these 17th century fears of Irish Catholic armies and later colonial fears of French Catholic Canadians being used as an instrument of royal tyranny. In both cases, government accommodations with foreign Catholic subjects spread terror and paranoia among Englishmen and contributed to the outbreak of hostilities. I've always been a bit more interested in how the American colonists remembered the Civil War. Thomas Jefferson admitted to cribbing material from the pamphlets of the 1640s, and John Adams, when he was the American envoy to Britain, toured the Civil War battle sites of Edge Hill and Worcester, which he referred to as holy ground. More broadly, the tensions of the 1760s and 1770s seem to have sparked a revival of Oliver Cromwell as a folk hero in New England, perhaps unsurprising, considering the Puritan origins of the northern colonies. Oliver became a much more popular baby name in the 1770s, and Connecticut in particular seems to have embraced the old Lord Protector. Some colonists boasted that Cromwell, along with John Pym and John Hampden, had considered migrating to Connecticut before the Civil War, and two vessels in the state's Revolutionary Navy were named after Oliver Cromwell. More broadly, I think many of the ideas that fueled the American Revolution were born, or at least refined, during the turbulent middle decades of the 17th century. I get the sense that the Glorious Revolution of 1688-89 produced a more coherent vocabulary for the revolutionaries, but many of the arguments and debates in Philadelphia or Boston would have been comprehensible to Bulstrode Whitelock, John Lambert, or Edward Hyde. Another listener, Finbar, was also interested in the long-term legacy of the Commonwealth and Protectorate period, though within Great Britain itself. Finbar asks if we're not a bit mistaken in thinking about the Commonwealth and Protectorate period as the Republican road not taken by English history. Instead, Cromwell and his friends did as much as anyone else to set England on the path it ended up taking through the constitutional reforms of the following generations, and even into the scientific and industrial revolutions. I'd be inclined to agree. At first glance, the Commonwealth and Protectorate era can seem like a blip on the otherwise unbroken historical evolution of the monarchy. But on closer inspection, the legacy of the 1640s and 1650s can be found throughout these subsequent centuries. The Restoration was not a comprehensive repudiation of what had come before, despite the efforts of some royalists. The constitutional and religious ideology of the period was not snuffed out. The same goes for practical affairs, like government bureaucracy and the economy. Charles II was canny enough to see the value of the administrative apparatus he inherited. Although he populated his council with friends and allies, as his father and grandfather had, day-to-day affairs were run by the kinds of civil servants the Republican regime had employed. The king's brother, James, Duke of York, was the Lord Admiral, but his administration was nothing like the personal fiefdom the Duke of Buckingham had run in the 1620s. Management of the navy fell to a commission of dedicated bureaucrats, just as it had under the Rump, or Cromwell. You could also make the case that the foundations of the modern English economy were set during the 1650s. Whether a product of war, republican governance, or general turmoil, the England that emerged in 1660 was quite different from the one that witnessed the outbreak of the Civil War in 1642. In a 20-year span, England saw remarkable experimentation in taxation, public finance, and international trade policy. These, in turn, spurred developments outside of government, for instance, the emergence of a mature and innovative financial sector. Many of the defining features of Restoration England, and even later eras, have their roots in the Civil War and its aftermath. Finally, Danny Buck, Norfolk's most celebrated witchfinder, asks what aspect of the Stuart era surprised me the most. I've given this a lot of thought, and I'd have to say that it might be the continuities of the era. The Englands of 1610, 1642, and 1659 can seem like entirely different worlds, and yet some people somehow lived in all three of them. If Lord Protector Cromwell met the 30-year-old version of himself, struggling to keep his head afloat in Huntingdon, would they even recognize one another? Or were they roughly the same person? England was the one that had changed. I guess surprised might not be the best word, but that's certainly what I find so fascinating about the 17th century. Politics, economics, and society in general were changing so rapidly, and yet people had to find a way to adapt. I suppose it's not that remarkable to us, where we expect to see rapid changes virtually on a yearly basis. But in a world where continuity and the durability of tradition were taken for granted, the ever-changing environment must have been incomprehensible. So I suppose, in a roundabout way, that's my answer. The surprising thing to me is how someone like Edward Hyde was able to make sense of the world he found himself in, despite it being unexpectedly and quite suddenly alien. Which I suppose is a good segue into my own navel-gazing thoughts on the podcast. I feel like I've learned a lot over the past 4 years, from how radical constitutional change can be affected, to the relationship between narrative and history, to just how much sound waves can bounce off the walls of a bedroom. Probably the most lasting and often repeated lesson has been about context. The early Stuart period, like any other period, I suppose, lends itself to pithy, easy-to-remember assessments. James I was an irresponsible spendthrift. William Laud led an Inquisition in the Church of England. The Fifth Monarchists were a bunch of religious wackadoodles. Oliver Cromwell was a bloodthirsty tyrant. Each of them have an element of truth about them, but when taken in isolation, they can give a misleading impression of the early 17th century world. The closer you look at any historical moment or figure, the more those helpful shorthands break down, to the point that it can be difficult to have any faith in any kind of narrative structure altogether. More than once over the course of this project, I stopped and thought about what I was leaving out, or what avenues I chose not to pursue, and how those choices shaped the narrative as much as what was included. But maybe that's getting a bit too meta. Perhaps a more constructive way to talk about context is to keep it tangible. In the 17th century, England's story wasn't just England's. It was also the story of Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. Not to mention Europe, America, India, Africa, and even littler corners of the globe like Newfoundland, closely linked to the West Country fishing industry. Neither is the story of England's constitutional revolutions the exclusive property of Westminster and Whitehall. London, as an entirely separate political institution, played a prominent role, and so too did events and people in Yorkshire, Cornwall, East Anglia, Cheshire, the Midlands, and all places in between. It's perhaps impossible to squeeze all that into a coherent explanation of 6 decades of history, but it was fun to try. I suppose that's what fascinates me the most about history. I'm always drawn by the promise of solving the puzzle, unlocking the secret explanations for why things happened the way they did, why people made the decisions they did. But a perfect understanding always remains elusive. Was the Civil War the inevitable outcome of a flawed and ambiguous political system? Was it the product of incompetence on the part of Charles I? Was England's experiment with republicanism a dead end on the march to constitutional monarchy? Or did it lay the groundwork for the liberties that underpin the British Constitution today? I'm not sure I'm in any better position to answer questions like that than I was 4 years ago. At least I don't feel like I'm able to give any kind of conclusive answer. But conclusions are overrated anyway. And on that note, let me once again thank all of you for making this grand experiment possible. It's been more fun than I could have imagined, and hopefully I'll see you all again out there.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.